Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Normalcy may be under siege in the broader world, but its hegemony persists here. Two guests, two segments. Paolo Gerbato will tell us about the rise of the Chinese electric vehicle firm BYD, and Andrew Hartman will review the history of Karl Marx's reception in and influence on the U.S. Last week, I interviewed Kyle Chan on Chinese industrial policy and the country's economic challenges to the U.S. We talked some about BYD, the Chinese electric vehicle, EV, manufacturer, which is leaving Tesla in the dust. I promised more this week, and here it is. The economic sociologist Paolo Gerbato has been studying the company, where it came from, where it's going, and he's written up his research in a couple of articles in Phenomenal World, one from April 2024 and the other from April 2025. It's quite a story. Founded as a battery company in 2003, it acquired a failing car maker a few years later and launched its first hybrid car in 2008. There are now about 80 EV makers in China, where the government deliberately stokes over capacity in a practice of engineered Darwinism designed to discover which firms are the most competitive. At least for now, BYD has taken the lead, initially on the basis of domestic sales, but it is now expanding both sales and production globally. Here's Paolo Gerbato with more. He's an economic sociologist at Complutense University in Madrid, an institution, by the way, founded in 1293. Paolo's most recent book is The Great Recoil, Politics After Populism and Pandemic, published by Verso in 2021. Paolo Gerbato. You open your piece from a year ago, last April, by recalling the Japanese shock to the U.S. and European car industries. Before we get to the Chinese challenge, could you just recall that dramatic event from, 50 years ago?
I think it was a very traumatic event for the Western car industry, as it was the first time that such a strategic industry was challenged from without. Japan was becoming part of the famous capitalist triad, but still it was a challenge to the Fordist model of management. It was actually a first manifestation of the success of the post-Fordist model. It was both an economic challenge and a cultural challenge because it was underpinned by this new Toyota model of business, which was based on a system of flexible production that was very different from the one the European car industry was used to. It was also a political shock. I mean, in the Gremlins, in the famous film, there is a character who is a chauvinist who hates Japanese cars.
There was a lot of that at that time. Sorry.
As he sees basically Japanese cars as a threat to the superiority, right, of U.S. technology. But those cars were cheaper, they were more efficient, and they were also better in quality in many respects. One of the elements of the Toyota model was quality control. So they had less defects, they were more designed with a user at the center. It is a very telling moment what happened 50 years ago with this Japanese tsunami of cars, because in many ways it also is similar to the moment we're living now with the Chinese wave of electric vehicles.
A word about the centrality auto industry. Having or not having an auto industry is almost a measure of how serious a country is economically. What has historically the role of the auto industry been in capitalist manufacturing?
When people think about Ford, right, as the paradigm of mass production, and when people think about, you know, the T model, the famous T model, as an icon of industrial development, one of the first kind of mass-produced goods, is not by chance. It's not that whatever the car industry is picked out of many industries just because it is whatever more symbolic or something else. It's because indeed the automotive industry is an industry that is extremely complex from all points of view. It requires enormous investments in infrastructure, in plants. It's a high knowledge industry. To produce a car, there's so much science, so much information, so much technology that goes into a car. And also it is, in line with the famous expression, an industry of industries, and therefore an index of the level of the industrial development of a country, because you can only have a car industry if you have previously developed a number of input industries and enabling technologies that go into the car. You need chemistry, you need metals, you need, of course, mining, you need logistics. Now you need batteries. And therefore, there are only a very small number of countries that can actually master this variety of challenges and integrate them. And of course, also there are huge managerial challenges there. You also need qualified workers, more so these days when the workers in automotive production plants are very different from the workers, right? We have in mind from the 40s period. Therefore, I mean, to check all these conditions, it's a huge challenge that only few countries in the world can actually meet.
Okay, now the role of Japan 50 years later is being played by China. At first, they look like low-end competitors in the auto market, but as they have in other industries, they're moving upscale. So, tell us about this contour of Chinese progress along the value chain of the auto business.
Japan and China is actually a very good way to look at the current state of affairs, because I mean, one of the main legacies of the Japanese success in the auto industry is the fact that to this day, the biggest car company in the world is still Toyota. We can say that now, probably in 10 years' time, Toyota will not be anymore the first car company in the world. It will probably be displaced by a Chinese company. This is not entrepreneurial magic. I mean, partly there is an element of entrepreneurial genius, which we need to give perhaps to capitalists, right? I mean, there are entrepreneurs such as Wang Chuanfu, I mean, the CEO of BYD, who really pursued a dream. He was lucky enough to earn a PhD in chemistry, which at his time was a very unexciting subject because not many new discoveries were being made in chemistry until battery chemistry, right, of lithium batteries in particular, really revolutionized the field. So he happened to sit on the right knowledge and expertise. It's quite interesting the history of Wang Chuanfu because he made the choice. So BYD starts as a battery firm. It was the firm that was producing the batteries that went into Nokia phones and Motorola phones. They were famed for having these never-ending batteries. Those were batteries that were produced actually by BYD. So until basically the turn of the millennium, it was a battery company. Until Wang Chuanfu made this entrepreneurial choice, which in strict economic terms looked like complete folly. So he decided to acquire a dying state-owned car firm. In China, still around half of car firms are owned by the state, either centrally in Beijing, more frequently locally, one of the 20 provinces. So he bought this firm in Xi'an. It was an internal combustion engine firm, and actually, he did it without informing shareholders. So the stock price of BYD, and we're talking about a story that is more than 20 years old, but the stock of BYD took a very severe hit because the shareholders basically said, I mean, what the hell are you doing? I mean, we are a battery firm. Why are you buying a car firm? But ultimately, right, this choice proved very true. Somehow he foresaw that the batteries that at this time were powering very small electrodomestics, phones, you name it, lamps, would progressively power vans, even trucks, buses, and so on and so forth, revolutionizing the automotive industry.
The structure of BYD is very vertically integrated, right? They do a lot of the work internally. It almost looks like a return of the old Fordist days, the Rouge plant and such.
Yes, this is very interesting because that's partly what really attracted me to studying BYD. Because it seemed to be one of many phenomena that these days somehow contradict things that we took for granted from, I mean, the broadly defined neoliberal era. And one element there was precisely this idea of post-Fordism, that we had moved away from all these big behemoths such as Ford and General Motors.
That was partly the effect of the Japanese auto competition you were talking about earlier, right? That new model of industrial organization.
Exactly. The idea of the Toyota model was ultimately externalizing many elements of your production and your value chain, outsourcing them to your environment of suppliers, which would be in a very difficult position as they would have basically no other people to go but you. You would be the only customer, right? So you would be able to drive down their prices more and more. and actually that's where the worst exploitation would happen for workers. This is what many automotive firms around the world have done. They have focused only on very high profit activities, such as design, assembly, distribution, and so on and so forth, leaving all the production of components to other firms that find themselves in this extremely competitive scenario, right, where their margins are very small, and therefore the only way to do it is either to pay workers very small wages, to fight against unions so that workers cannot raise their wages, or to whatever, use accounting tricks, or to offshore, of course, right, to move production to countries with lower labor costs. Instead, with BYD, we see a different story. We see a story where one firm produces as much as 70% of the entire elements that go into the car. A recent report, on the BYD seal precisely identified this kind of rough figure of around 70% in terms of the value of the components that go into the car that were produced directly by BYD. BYD produces the batteries, which are, of course, the most strategic component in what are battery-powered cars. It produces electronics and microchips and all the navigational apparatus of the car, which proved a huge competitive advantage already during the first Trump administration, when we remember that Trump tried to throttle the Chinese economy precisely by exploiting the bottleneck of microchips, the advantage the US had and still partly has in that sector, while BYD was producing those components in-house, right? So it didn't have to worry that much. It even has acquired lithium mining companies in order to directly have access to the primary material, which of course is decisive for the production of batteries. And most interestingly of all, perhaps most iconic of all, it has even acquired these Ro-Ro ships, these enormous ships that are used to transport cars across the ocean. And these also proved a competitive advantage because around the time of COVID, there was at some point a shortage of these ships, which made it difficult for other companies to supply cars to their final markets. So this is quite curious why this is happening. Actually, it's not something that only BYD is doing. Partly also Tesla was doing that. Even SpaceX has strong elements of internalization. And one of the answers is precisely technological. Vertical integration is beneficial at times of very rapid technological transformation, where you cannot really afford as a company to constantly negotiate with various suppliers and give them specifications. You need to move much faster in a much more integrated manner, right? So it's much better for you to produce as much as you can yourself, because you are transforming different elements of the vehicle as you go along. So you want basically to have all the different components, say, in sync with one another, which you can best do, of course, if they are integrated in the same company. And partly it is testament to the fact that EVs are a superior technology in terms of their power, in terms of their efficiency, energy efficiency, in terms of their performance. They are much more kind of sports car than any internal combustion engine can actually do, but it's also a simpler technology. They have between 1/8 and 1/10 of the moving components of an internal combustion engine, which means that partly the components that go into the car are less complex. The number is smaller, which means that it's easier to integrate all of these into a car. So this is a change in management practices and in management philosophy, which also, I think, has much broader implications, including political implications.
I'm speaking with the economic sociologist, Paolo Girbaudo. From what you've said, the founder of BYD is quite a skilled entrepreneur, but I'm guessing the Chinese state also had a hand in this.
Completely. I mean, this is the point I wanted to make before I went on a digression. China is market socialism, is neither market nor socialism 100%. Is this strange mix where it has, in a way, some of the creative, though destructive, elements of capitalism, sometimes almost recreated in a lab, a sort of engineered Darwinism geared towards achieving productivity and technological supremacy. It's almost really like a lab, you know. It's like the Chinese state that creates this environment which is ultra competitive with too many firms, too much productive capacity, and ultimately someone will survive, and those that survive, of course, they are not just national champions, but global champions, if they make it in such a challenging environment. No? But it's more of a Darwinism of entrepreneurs. Not that Chinese workers on average have a good life or salary, but in this case, it's a Darwinism where it's entrepreneurs that either survive or disappear. But this is an element in a much broader plan where state intervention by the Chinese state is fundamental. What we are seeing now with the EV sector is the result of the Chinese response to the 2007-2008 crisis. I mean, while Western countries, in particular European countries, decided that the response to that was austerity. In China, they had 10% of GDP stimulus for some years, and they used that for A, building up their high-speed rail network, which they went literally from 0 kilometers to being now the countries that have more high-speed line railway lines than any other country. I mean, I think it's 40,000 kilometers or more. It's going to be incredible. And B, they decided basically in the future there will be these strategic technologies, and one of these technologies will be electric vehicles. And we want to have a piece of that. At the time, nobody believed in the Chinese car industry. Nobody bought Chinese cars outside of China.
Elon Musk used to laugh at them, right?
Totally. In a famous interview in 2013, 2014, he said, whatever, this cheap, low-quality technology, which, to be fair, it was the image of the popular image of Chinese technology until quite recently.
But that's only like 10 years ago.
Yes, I mean, Chinese production was famous for household goods and for shoes and like clothes and producing components for electronic goods. Elon Musk, of course, nobody wants to defend it. And his comment was a manifestation of arrogance, and I would say also of racism of Westerners towards the Chinese, that has proven quite unwise for the good of Western capitalism. But to be fair, the process has been so fast that they have taken by surprise, perhaps even themselves. The Chinese state has spent billions and billions in these in different ways through subsidies to research, enormous subsidies to research, subsidies to producers, and subsidies to buyers. So it's like whatever, Bidenomics, the things that Joe Biden did in terms of subsidizing the IRA, blah, blah. It was really copy and paste what the Chinese had done 10 years before, but at a smaller scale. And besides these, something that was very interesting for me to understand, to discover as I was studying this, is not just the central Chinese state in Beijing that does this. It's the central Chinese state in Beijing, but then each one of the 20 provinces of China does it. They are around kind of 50 million people each or more. They have their own industrial policy. So they are doing just the same. As in the case of Shanghai, they have sometimes their own state-owned car firm. And they are subsidizing private firms, they are subsidizing buyers, they are offering land at a very cheap price to production. This series of interventions, public interventions, have been crucial in creating the terrain, right, in creating the environment for the EV industry to thrive.
BYD started as a very domestic company, both production and its markets, but they are internationalizing both production and markets. Right now they're beginning to export vehicles, and they're also looking into expanding production abroad.
Yes. At the outset, Chinese car industry was very much a domestic phenomenon. It was domestic production for domestic consumption. And I think still in 2024, around 85% of all Chinese cars were purchased locally. And this is an enormous advantage for Chinese automotive producers because they operate in what is the largest market for automotive in the world, which is essentially, to a great extent, a captive market, which is defended by a number of protectionist measures in one way or another, where they already have infrastructure, such as charging points. I mean, another important public policy there, of course, is the state making sure there are charging points. To make it easier for people to purchase a car. But progressively, Chinese firms are looking overseas for markets for the produce, also because the degree of the investment in production plants and in technology and in research, which they've invested in, is not sustainable unless if now 80% of cars are consumed, 85 in China and 15 outside of China, the split in the future should be something closer to kind of 60% in China to 40% in China for that industrial model to be sustainable. So what we have seen, the very interesting thing of the last 2 years really, is that it all happened so fast. In 2023, in the last quarter, BYD overcame for the first time Tesla as the producer of new energy vehicle in general, including both battery energy vehicle, so say pure electric vehicles, as well as plug-in electric vehicles. What they've done is looking for markets, starting, this is very interesting how they're expanding, because it speaks a lot about Chinese geoeconomics and EV geoeconomics, but also about Chinese geopolitics. The first stage of expansion is China's immediate neighborhood, namely Southeast Asia. So they build plants in Indonesia, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in Thailand. This is a region that encompasses almost kind of around kind of 500 million people just outside of China. So it's an obvious place where to start for overseas markets. But then they are also expanding to Central Asia, right, to Uzbekistan on the famous Silk Road. Pakistan, which famously is a very strong ally of China, while India has a very fraught relationship with China. So, for example, there's no EV plant of BYD in India, interestingly, despite the obvious opportunity the market would offer. But the final target for Chinese EVs, in particular for BYD, is, of course, Europe, which is the second largest market for EVs. And is a place where BYD really wants to be very competitive. So they have built a factory which is almost ready to open in Hungary, which is the recipient of much of Chinese foreign direct investments. And they're expanding further in Turkey and probably in Germany. So which just gives the sense of the scale of this expansion, I mean, and how fast it is happening.
You describe the protected market in China, domestic market, with, you know, tariffs and other barriers. You know, Trump wants to throw up tariff barriers, but none of the industrial policy that went along with it that made it all worthwhile. Trump just sees the obstruction, but none of the positive development.
I think it's really interesting to think about different forms of state interventionism. They've never disappeared, but some of them are coming back in redoubled form, right? And the two main ones are subsidies and tariffs. And it's really partly in the context of U.S. politics is Biden versus Trump. It's not that Biden was any less protectionist than Trump, at least in theory. He famously won the presidency on the back of a slogan like Made in America. He was, in certain respects, he was an economic nationalist, at least in his discourse. But his main policy instrument was the subsidies. It was the main policy instrument of Biden was subsidies, more specifically conditional subsidies on firms producing EVs, with the idea that this would accelerate the transition towards green technology, electric vehicles, and so on and so forth. Actually, this is the main instrument that also China uses. China doesn't like to use tariffs. As Arrighi, in a way, predicted in the famous book Adam Smith in Beijing, paradoxically, China, communist China now, is one of the biggest fans of the global markets. They are very happy to exchange goods with low tariff barriers, but their protectionism is more in terms of subsidies, supporting local and national champions and putting them in a place where they can be extremely competitive internationally. So the advantage of these vis-a-vis tariffs is that it can be much more targeted and focused on the actual leading products, as Wallerstein called them, right, that you want to export abroad, rather than being generalized reciprocal tariffs as the one Trump has put forward, though we don't even know where they're going to end, because they're suspended and then reduced and then increased. Is this complete chaos? So I think that the superiority of Chinese economic policy lies in the fact that there is the sense of a real long-term plan. They don't care if they are competitive in whatever, in some very low-value production. They want to be competitive in high-tech, in the most critical technologies of the day, and therefore they will funnel these subsidies in these very specific areas and while at the same time trying as much as they can to maintain an open trade climate internationally, because of course this is always what leading capitalist nations have done, right, at the point of their hegemony. Once they have achieved technological superiority and industrial superiority, they will be more than happy to operate under a free trade regime.
That was Paulo Gibato, a researcher at Complutense University in Madrid, and author of two articles, A Phenomenal World on the Rise of BYD. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Drive My Car, a 1981 song by Nasty Facts, a group of Brooklyn teens who formed the band a few years earlier. They met at St. Anne's School, not exactly the mean streets. Next, Marx in the USA. While hyper-capitalist American culture generally isn't naturally hospitable to socialism, especially the German variety, Marx was fascinated by the U.S., and Americans have been fascinated by him, though not always out of admiration. Attention to Marx has ebbed and flowed over the decades. We're now in something of a flow phase after a couple of decades of ebb. This long and complicated relationship, from the early days to the present, is the topic of a new book by Andrew Hartman, Karl Marx in America, published by the University of Chicago Press. He is a professor of history at Illinois State University. Andrew Hartman. Most Americans would think, or many Americans would think, even a lot of leftist Americans would think, that the relationship of Marx in America is mostly one of hostility from the American side, that this has just been a very unhospitable soil for Marxism. We're just too deeply involved in capitalism and individualism, and even our left is not necessarily all that amenable to Marxism. What do you say to that general indictment?
Well, it's not entirely untrue, but I guess I would make at least two qualifications. First of all, lots of people on the left have indeed engaged with Marx going all the way back to the late 19th century up through the emergence of the Socialist Party of America in the early 20th century. And also lots of anti-Marxists, liberals, and conservatives have in fact engaged with Marx, and part of their project of understanding the American project through their eyes has been in conversation with Marx, often as hostile conversants, and yet Marx has proved important to their construction of what they consider an American liberal or conservative political tradition.
And of course, opposition to Marxism has really energized generations of American, not just reactionaries, but liberals as well. He's really like the bad guy they'd like to play good guy to.
Yeah, surprising to me a little bit was the number of liberals in the early Cold War, these Cold War liberals or mid-century liberals, how many of them engaged with Marx. And they did so to perform an exorcism of sorts because many of them were favorable interpreters of Marx during the 1930s, or at least knew people who were. But also their formulation of an American liberal political tradition during this time period was predicated on a negative interpretation of Marx. The American project in their eyes had proven Marx wrong. Liberalism had conquered in their eyes fascism, ignoring the role of the Soviet commies. And liberalism was going to conquer communism. The New Deal, which is the sort of quintessential liberal project as these mid-century liberals thought of it, had proven that Marxism was completely unnecessary and had rendered Marx's ideas about the immiseration of the proletariat wrong.
Okay, let's step back to the beginning of your story. Marx had some hopes that American political democracy could overcome rule by money. This is a society that never knew feudalism. It didn't have a lot of that European prehistory. And in some senses, it was one of the more democratic parts of the world, or maybe the most democratic part of the world in its early days, with some notable exceptions, notably slavery. But he did have some hopes that this country had possibilities from his point of view. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, so Marx had read many of these European travelogues, Tocqueville, the most famous. Whereas Tocqueville and others were writing from an aristocratic perspective, they were horrified by the democracy in America. Marx quite liked it, and he thought to himself, in reading about groups like the Working Men's Party in Philadelphia and New York City, he thought that universal suffrage, though we know it was limited to white men, but it was still quite impressive relative to what Europeans had at the time. He thought that, well, the working people, why wouldn't they usher in socialism or at least working class power, working class rule, given the vote? Marx changed his mind quite a bit about American democracy over time, had a famous argument in On the Jewish Question about the distinction between formal democracy or formal freedom and real freedom. The fact that as capitalism sort of settles into society, most people don't have freedom in their everyday lives, don't have control over their labor, over their bodies, over their time, to him was a huge gap in the theory of American democracy. Marx also believed, sort of anticipating Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis, but through a glass darkly, that the frontier allowed for lots of working people to sort of escape class struggle. And he saw this as temporary, but a real inhibitor to socialism. He also saw slavery, of course, as the main barrier to working class solidarity. All of that said, he did have some hopes for American democracy.
Now, what about the early reactions to Marx in the United States? As you write, the Yankee radicals were less impressed than the German immigrants, those 48ers you were just talking about.
Yeah, so this is the beginning of a long trend in the reception of Marx in the United States. American radicalism has like many different sort of sensibilities, and this is true early on. The Yankee radicals, they liked Marx, they liked some of his ideas, but to him it was just one of the many radical ideas, from free love to various forms of feminism to bohemianism. And you see this moral left across American history, which sometimes engages with Marx, sometimes seeks to shape or contort Marx's ideas to their views of the good life. There was early on and continued this tension on the American left between a Marxism that seemed much more focused on class dynamics and class struggle, and a radicalism that understood freedom, the fight for freedom, in many other iterations.
And if we look at the later 19th century with the rise of the populist movement, there are many virtues to the populist, but we can still feel this today in American radicalism. There was also this kind of small is beautiful, local, anti-big city, anti-monopolist, very rural, self-reliant, kind of petty bourgeois capitalism. How did that fit in with Marxism?
Yeah, I think this is a tension. So there's been a bunch of scholarship recently on Marx's republicanism, small r republicanism. And the populists, to some degree, were small r republicans in the sense that they hated arbitrary power. But the populists were also, as Charles Postel and other scholars have convincingly argued, despite their seeming radicalism, they were small scale capitalists. The thing that they opposed was East Coast corporate capitalism that was imposing upon their ability to earn profits on a smaller scale. And so the question of land is an important one, and that is that whereas Marx saw everybody sort of moving towards one of two classes, and most people would become a proletariat or an industrial working class, the populists were trying to sort of protect something that a Marxist probably thought was going by the wayside historically, and that is like small property owners. It was a Jeffersonian vision. And so this is another tension in American radicalism in the late 19th century.
And it didn't have much to say to the urban working class. The farmers wanted higher food prices, among other things. And
Exactly. There's a contradiction there. Populists wanted inflation. That's not going to do much for that's not going to do much for an urban working class reliant upon wages.
Moving on to the substantial figure of Eugene Debs, who absorbed a lot of Marxism. How does he figure into your story?
the key moment in the first major favorable interpretation of Marx in the United States is the emergence of the Socialist Party of America, which forms in 1901 out of the death of a bunch of different socialist parties. And one of the reasons it's able to emerge and capture most socialists across the United States is because of the figure of Debs. On the one hand, he's born in Terre Haute, Indiana. He has these Christian, populist, utopian, small R Republican roots. And so he's able to speak to, for example, Oklahoma socialists who joined the Socialist Party in great number in the early 20th century because they didn't really have an alternative option after the People's Party dies.
You write something about those Oklahoma socialists. Who were they? It's very, you know, it's certainly not something one thinks of in connection with Oklahoma these days.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great trivia question. Which state had the most socialists in the early 20th century? It's Oklahoma. Most of them had been populists, members of the People's Party. These are tenant farmers hurting badly. The Democratic Party is the dominant party in Oklahoma at the time. It's not serving their interests. The Republican Party was hardly visible, and so many of them turned to the Socialist Party. They had a sort of motto of Marx, Jesus, and Jefferson. They modified Marxism, and what's interesting is Debs could speak to them, but he could also speak to the German immigrant socialists in places like New York and Milwaukee who had a much more sort of bookish, theoretical interpretation of Marx. Debs could speak to them because he had done the reading. When he was in prison in Woodstock, he begins reading Marx and other Marxist literature, and this persists, and he increasingly has a Marx class-based interpretation of how to struggle against capitalism, even as he's able, as a good politician, to speak across audiences.
Now, you just mentioned Marx, Jesus, and what was the third?
Jefferson, yeah.
You would think that these three influences are not compatible with each other. How did Debs manage to pull off some kind of hybridization?
Even though you might not think this, or many Americans might not think this because he never came close to winning the presidency, he was an effective politician from the point of view of being a socialist leader. He was able to speak in a register that religious socialists or Oklahomans or populists would understand. He could sort of like reference the Sermon on the Mount at the same time as he's referencing the labor theory of value. And it just kind of depended on which audience he was speaking to. But this is kind of like one of the unusual things about the American reception of Marx is like there are all these hybrid versions, these weird mixings that probably a German socialist would not recognize.
Now, the urban Jewish population, particularly a place like New York, was also a very important seat of early American Marxism. How did they fit in with the broader national conversation with Marxism?
Yeah, so there's a great book by Tony Michaels on this, on Yiddish socialists in New York City. And he makes the case convincingly, to my mind, that these Russian and Eastern European Jews, Yiddish-speaking Jews who immigrated to New York City and other places, usually on the East Coast, in the late 19th and early 20th century, they assimilated into New York City by joining the German socialist culture that had been a really important part of the working class in New York City since, say, the 1870s. And this German socialist culture was very Marx-centric, going all the way back to many of Marx's friends and comrades who were reading Marx, putting Marx in their journals as early as the 1870s. Like, for example, the 18th Brumaire, one of Marx's most famous essays, is first published in a New York City German language journal. And so there's this really interesting mixing of Eastern European Jews who were prone to radicalism to begin with, but especially when many of them end up in textile factories in New York City, to working class radicalism, mixing of them with a very Marx-centric German socialist population. And this mixing of these two immigrant groups across two different waves of immigration to the United States that creates a very strong presence for socialists and later even communists in cities like New York, Chicago, Milwaukee, Cincinnati.
I'm speaking with Andrew Hartman, author of Karl Marx in America, just out from the University of Chicago Press. What did the Russian Revolution do for Marxism in America?
Well, so in the run-up to the First World War, I think this is the high point of American socialism, largely because Debs and the Socialist Party were able, as I said, to capture all these different variables. World War One gives the state at the federal, but also especially at the state and local level, the excuse and power to crush these radical movements, especially groups like the Wobblies, who had been annoying them for decades. So repression is a very real thing, even before the Bolshevik Revolution. That just picks up pace after the Bolshevik Revolution, when people like J. Edgar Hoover, who is forming eventually what becomes the FBI at the time, is sort of in charge of chasing down radicals and sees his mission as preventing a Bolshevik Revolution in the United States. For those who remained on the left and remained in the United States, didn't get deported to Russia, and stayed out of jail, they were very inspired by the Bolshevik Revolution, understandably. Like, Marxists like themselves had taken power in a large nation. But it made them less inclined to think that democracy or the ballot box was the correct path towards revolution. They started thinking in terms of, like, forming a party or a cadre. And because of the repression, they also, many of them who formed the early Communist Party in the United States, went underground and became sort of a secret organization, not to come up for air and become a public organization until the 1930s.
What were the conditions for the founding of that Communist Party? This is not a particularly revolutionary time, not that there are many revolutionary times in American history, but how did the CP emerge?
Because of the inspiration provided by the Bolshevik Revolution, many people who had been in the Socialist Party, native-born radicals like John Reed, but also many of the Eastern European groups who were members of the Socialist Party and who had these close attachments to the Bolsheviks. They wanted to, first of all, take the Socialist Party in a Bolshevik direction, but when that proved impossible, they broke away, formed a different couple of parties, which eventually coalesced in the Communist Party USA in about 1921-22, and they become a part of the Communist International. Many of them spend time in the Soviet Union learning the ropes of Communist Internationalism. And so the Communist Party is formed in an era of sectarianism, it's formed in an era of repression, and it's formed in an era of inspiration from the Bolshevik Revolution and in direct close contact with the Bolsheviks themselves.
And of course, the crash, the depression changed a lot of things. CP became a lot more prominent, a lot more popular. So how did it do in the 30s?
Yeah, the Communist Party grows immensely during the 1930s, and this is sort of the high water mark for class struggle in U.S. history, but also the high water mark for Americans reading Marx favorably, especially up until 1935 or the Second New Deal. There's just like waves and waves of militant labor radicalism. You get the formation of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which takes a much different approach to labor organizing, much more democratic across racial and ethnic and religious lines. You get general strikes such as the San Francisco, which starts on the docks in 1934. You get strikes in textile mills and factories across the East Coast in 1934. There's just a general sense of upheaval, especially up until the mid-1930s. And the working class, probably never before or since been so militant in U.S. history.
Unusually for such a predominantly white organization, black Americans played an important part in the CP's history, right?
That's exactly right. The Communist Party, especially when it sees as one of its missions organizing within the CIO and also organizing in places like Harlem. Robin Kelly's written a book about communists in Alabama during the 1930s. So yeah, even though black Americans have never sort of proportionally been a part of left-wing organizations, maybe up until the 1960s, they do play a prominent role. There were black socialists, but there were a lot of black communists, including those who had studied and been trained in Moscow.
And then we move ahead into the 1950s, which were a very dark period, the Red Scare. Well, how did Marx fare during those dark days?
As you might imagine, not well. But Marx doesn't go away because, as I mentioned earlier, liberals read him intensely to prove him wrong. Conservatives are also reading him, and some are actually reading him, unlike today's conservatives. But, of course, they're interpreting Marx and using Marx as a figurehead, not to prove him wrong. To them, that was a foregone conclusion, but rather to demonstrate that liberalism and Marxism were part of the same project, because for conservatives, liberalism of the New Deal sort was their true enemy. There are a couple of Marxists here and there, independent socialists who formed, like, for example, the magazine Monthly Review. There are these sort of offshoot former Trotskyist groups groups like the Johnson Forest Tendency, which includes C.L.R. James and Raya Dunaskaeva and Grace Lee, who are reading Marx, translating Marx, writing about Marx, coming up with some pretty interesting stuff. But for the most part, Marx is sort of like out of the mainstream as a favorable figure and really just sort of a demonized figure.
Come to the 1960s, my late friend Bob Fitch, who was at Berkeley in the 60s, said when he got there, just before the explosion of the free speech movement, he said everybody in Berkeley was at a Marx reading group. So that was the prehistory of the free speech movement. So I don't think a lot of people appreciate that that was happening. But there was a particular interest in a young early humanist Marx, as opposed to, I guess, the inhumanist later Marx. But what was about that flavor of Marxism that was so popular in the 60s?
Finally, the young Marx was made available to an American readership in the post-war era, in part because of like people like Grace Lee and Raya Dunaskaeva, who had translated the young Marx. And there's something sort of brooding and existentialist about the young Marx talking about alienation that was attractive to young people who were unhappy with the state of things in the U.S., but of course were a part of a generation of people who, economically speaking, were probably doing better than ever. And so it wasn't the sort of labor-centric Marx, it wasn't the Marx of the working day chapter in Capital that was really attractive to them. It was rather, you know, like you can imagine a young Tom Hayden when he's writing the Port Huron Statement thinking about the young Marx who was writing about how humans were alienated in all these different ways. That Marx really spoke to a sort of countercultural flavor in the 1960s New Left.
Then there's also a challenge to Marxism in the 70s, coming from feminists, Robin Morgan, Juliet Mitchell, Shulamith Firestone. What did that challenge look like? How did it relate to Marxism?
So this was a challenge to the New Left in general. These feminists who came out of New Left organizations in part formed a new feminist movement or a women's liberation movement in part because they were disgusted by given sort of second class roles in the New Left organizations. You see something similar in their sort of new interpretations of Marx. The argument being that class is not the sort of primary historical mover of repression and revolution, rather gender is. The argument being that even after the socialist revolution, women will still be second-class citizens, or the argument that patriarchy preceded capitalism. There's that discourse, but then there's some really sort of interesting productive analyses through a feminist Marxist lens. For example, Angela Davis wrote what I consider a brilliant essay, while in prison, no less, using Marx and Engels and their theories on the family as a way to understand the role of women in reproductive labor.
The 80s and 90s were really bad days. You know, it wasn't McCarthy running after with the Red Scare, but it was this strange turn against any kind of critique of capitalism. It was the period of Reaganism, Clintonism, the consolidation of capitalist power and prestige. Not a great time for Marxism either.
No, not at all. And this is, you know, when I'm coming of age as a sort of Gen Xer. And so what I found is Marx was kept alive in academia. The sort of labor-centric Marx, or even a very political Marx of the 1960s New Left had gone away. Marx is not being read or used or talked about as a weapon in any sort of revolutionary class struggle, but rather Marx is one of the sort of central theorists that are helping people interpret a whole host of academic disciplines in the 1980s and 1990s, some of which was very pro-Marx, like I would say a Frederick Jameson, but becomes, at least to readers outside of the academic disciplines in which they worked or operated, becomes seemingly esoteric or just too jargonistic to really have any kind of political valence. And then you also get this whole like move towards critique of the canon, and Marx is part of the canon as a dead white man and thus doesn't offer us very convincing explanations for understanding things like racism and sexism. That's a popular move. And so it's not like Marx died. During this time period, the Communist Manifesto remains one of the most assigned texts across U.S. campuses. Marx is still there. He's still present, but not in the way in which he might have been in an era when there's a large socialist party or mass unions that were quite militant.
Now, that capitalist triumphalism, which helped marginalize Marx's intellectual life in the 80s and 90s, really came into great disrepute with the financial crisis of 2008. It's a very different world now. That sense of prosperity or restoration of prosperity is now gone. Where are we now with Marx and Marxist critiques generally?
That's the billion-dollar question. I've tracked a reemergence of interest in Marx. Marx is one of these figures who has helped many people understand and explain capitalism during and after the financial crisis of 2008. You see the emergence of a growing number of people interested in Marx, wrapped up in, I guess, what we might call millennial socialism. Very popular journals like Jacobin and the sort of like proliferation of Marx-ish podcasts, the growth of DSA and the Bernie Sanders campaigns. There is low-grade millennial socialism that has led lots of people to return to Marx. And out of this, you've seen a proliferation of books about Marx that have a much different tone than the ones that were written about him in the age of like Frederick Jameson and Derrida. These books, you can't like erase the academicization of Marx, and yet academics themselves, especially young grad students and emerging academics, have a much sort of clearer sense that they're a part of the working class because their lives or our lives are so much more precarious than they used to be. And so there's been a return to a focus on labor and the ways in which capitalism prevents us from being free because we spend so much of our time laboring or at work, which is a system of exploitation for the profit of others. So the original Marx that proved so influential to Gilded Age militant labor unions and the Socialist Party to some degree has returned, and there's been an emphasis on freedom. Why is it that, especially in a nation that is obsessed with the concept of freedom, capitalism prevents us from being free, even though you can't really name a mass movement that is attached to this renewed interest in Marx? The sort of lens through which Marx is being read makes me hopeful.
That was Andrew Hartman, professor of history at Illinois State and author of Karl Marx in America, published by the University of Chicago Press. It was funny to hear him mention the proliferation of Marxish podcasts in recent years. Behind the News has been at it on terrestrial radio as well as cyberspace for 30 years. Always ahead of the curve here. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of East Interlude by ZRK from Place, Morocco, a new compilation of Moroccan music by friend of Behind the News, Berksonist, herself from that country. There's a lot of great stuff in the album, which you can find in Bandcamp. Till next week, bye.